Okay. It's a very great pleasure tonight to introduce Dr. Reviel Netz as the 2018 Steiner Lecturer. This lecture series has been made possible through a gift from the Steiner family in memory of Andrew Steiner, an alumnus of the college from the class of 1963. He was a good student in all parts of the program, but he was noted above all for the loyalty and generosity he showed to his friends and to St. John's. It was in keeping with this that the lecture series was established, to bring notable speakers to our campus from a variety of disciplines and endeavors, in recognition of Andrew's intellectual versatility and for the sake of our continued learning. Dr. Netz is a professor of Greek mathematics and astronomy at Stanford University. He earned his bachelor's and master's degrees in ancient history and history of science at Tel Aviv University before earning his PhD in classics at Christ College, Cambridge. He's well known for his work on the so-called Archimedes Palimpsest, a manuscript unknown for many centuries that contained works of Archimedes that were otherwise unavailable, works that could be fully recovered only through ultraviolet and infrared analysis of the manuscript. He's published critical editions of several of Archimedes' treatises and is presently working on a new edition of exactly those works that we read in the St. John's program. In other works, he studied the transition from ancient to modern mathematics, with particular attention to the role of Arabic mathematicians in the development of the equation. It's a study quite appreciative of, but also drawing distinctions from, the work of Jacob Klein, familiar to many of us. I'd like to remind everyone that Professor Netz will also offer a seminar tomorrow morning from 10 to 11:30 in the Hartle Room in the Barbie Cannon Center on Archimedes' method. So please join me in welcoming Professor Reviel Netz.
Well, first of all, one thing to understand, one thing that's important, so maybe I can share something here that's not entirely evident. It's not floating bodies, and that's important. Maybe it does carry a meaning. The title floating bodies is a title that has evolved very gradually through the years, from the 16th century until basically it's only early in the 19th century that people start referring to this as the treatise of Archimedes on floating bodies. The Greek title, which we can actually see in the palimpsest, this is where we see it. You can see the writing hidden behind the script above. The title is Archimedus Ochumenon of Archimedes of things that float, of floaters, the book of floaters. It's an enigmatic, playful title, maybe. It's a title that jumps out of the bath. It's this kind of title. It's not classical mechanics. On floating bodies suggests, okay, here is the Corpuscle Protestorum fluid. This is the kind of thing that you do in the Newtonian program. It's not a Newtonian treatise. It's an Archimedean treatise, an enigmatic treatise, a Eureka jumping out of the bath treatise, I think. But we'll get to see what he's doing there. Well, you're familiar with it. You're familiar with this text. You've read this text, unlike pretty much everyone else in the world. But one thing about this text. So it has two books. It has two books, and they are divided by two basic hypotheses. There's an hypothesis concerning the behavior of the liquid. We'll get to this. An hypothesis concerning the behavior of the solid in liquid. And in between, we get two main results. One is that there are a liquid is a sphere, the spherical shape of the liquid. And the other one is the property of weight and movement of solids immersed in a liquid, essentially the law of buoyancy. This is where most of the physics-like work happens. And this is an introductory part of the treatise. Almost all of the action of the treatise takes place after the introduction of this extra hypothesis concerning the behavior of the solid in liquid, where things begin to be truly enigmatic, truly hard. So I'll talk about them a lot. This is the part that rarely gets read. This is where you're doing conditions of stability for various objects immersed in the liquid. I'll try to look at those. I'll try to say something about those. We tend to concentrate on buoyancy. For Archimedes, I think the main purpose was stability. So we'll need to get to this one. So I'll have to touch on many things. I'll bring many things, but maybe they'll add up. At any rate, each of them maybe will do something to push the discussion a bit further. So I want to point out, if Archimedes does physics here, he does not do unified physics. there doesn't seem to be an interest in unifying physics. There's not one physics, but two. I'll point out that there's something deeply geometrical about the logic, deeply pure, deeply abstract about the logic we'll get there. Specifically, and this once again is a very St. John's type of observation, this is very much a conic sections type of treatise, which we don't get if we're looking only at Bernstein. Specifically, maybe it has something to do with the very author Apollonius. We'll get to this. And ultimately, I'll say something about the reception of the work. I think I can bring a small piece of evidence that suggests that the reception of the work emphasized it as geometry. And this is what I'll push to, ultimately. I'll talk about this treatise really as belonging not so much to lab as to mathematics. It may be that the place to read Archimedes' floating bodies, I would say, this is blasphemous, is not as a cornerstone of physics, but it's something that is to be read alongside what we read when we read Apollonius. This will be my argument here. It is a place where the mechanical, the purpose of the mechanical, is to provide a field of meaning for geometry. Well, I'll try to make this clear. I'll try to clarify what I'm doing. So there's quite a bit on our plate, and I'll try to make progress now. I'll try to make progress through the various pieces of argument. So, first of all, I say that floating bodies is not one physics, but two. There are separate playbooks to different kinds of objects. So here is the liquid hypothesis. This is how we start the treatise. Let the liquid be assumed to have such a nature so that the less pressed of its parts, equally set and contiguous, is pushed out by the more pressed, and that each of its parts is pressed by the liquid perpendicularly above it. So that's the assumption concerning the liquid. That's the assumption concerning the liquid with which we begin the treatise, you've read this. And now, sandwiched in between the two main sections of the work, here's another hypothesis concerning solid and liquid. Let it be assumed that each of the solid magnitudes carried upwards in the liquid is carried along the perpendicular drawn through its center of the weight. So how do objects immersed in the liquid move? Of course, they move up if they're lighter than the liquid, and they move upwards, directly upwards. It's not clarified what it means precisely along the perpendicular, and defined by the center of the weight. This is what defines the behavior of the solid in liquid. Archimedes never states this, but it is taken for granted that the correlate assumption holds for objects that are outside of the liquid. Solids outside of the liquid are carried down in a perpendicular through the center of the weight. This is the assumption concerning the solids. Two different assumptions concerning liquids, concerning solids, and they are parallel to each other. They don't work together. Each works separately for different ends. There are distinct laws of mathematics that apply for solids and for liquids. If you're dealing with a solid, you go to one bookshelf to pick up one part of the book of the laws of nature. If you're dealing with solids, you pick up a different kind of book, a different kind of set of laws. Different laws hold. And it looks like Archimedes does imply this. There's one word which is crucial here. He says, let the liquid be assumed to have such a nature, which is interesting because it's actually redundant. He doesn't have to say this in terms of the Greek. He could easily say, let the liquid be assumed to be pressed when some of it is pressed in this way. It doesn't have to be, let the liquid be assumed to have such a nature that it is pressed. So he's saying something about physics, about nature. What he means is that there is a different physics to liquid. The hygron, the liquid, is this physics, and the stereon, the solid, is a different physics. He never says this, but that's what implied. Two physics, not one physics, two physics. There are two types of physics. And here is how it works. So you remember this, the question of liquid stability. How do we know if a piece of liquid is stable? What makes a liquid stable? Well, what makes a liquid stable is that if we have two such equal contiguous sections, they've got above them equal areas, equal volumes of liquid. That's what determines stability, because otherwise, if those are not equal to each other, the pressures here will be unequal, and the inequality of the pressures on these contiguous surfaces will create instability. This is what follows from the hypothesis. There's a completely different question that we're asking if we're asking whether a solid inside the liquid is stable. Here's a solid in a liquid. We'll take a look at it again. And it has two elements to its movement. There is the part that's immersed in the liquid, and it's a part that outside the liquid. The part that outside the liquid moves in this arrow downwards. The part that inside the liquid moves in this arrow upwards. When do we get stability? When the two arrows cancel each other out. When the two arrows push exactly against each other with the same force. In the same direction, opposite, in the same force. This is the condition of stability. The conditions of stability are completely distinct. And it is conceivable to think of unified physics. One could conceive of unified physics when you bring the two questions. You don't ask just one, you ask just two. For instance, it seems quite natural. This is wrong, but it is natural. It seems quite natural to assume that liquids balance, a liquid balances, when the centers of weight of its adjacent sections are equally set. So one could think that the problem about this particular arrangement, why the water will not stay on the side, is precisely because one sector of liquid is higher in terms of its center of gravity than the other, higher in terms of the center of its weight. It's completely conceivable as a thesis. In fact, it's a thesis that was enunciated in Archimedes' own time. Strato, a philosopher, a peripatetic philosopher, active a bit before Archimedes, let's say the generation of Archimedes' father, Strato has a theory explaining why the motion of the water from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean goes just in this direction. So is the hypothesis, which apparently is in and of itself not exactly correct. The water moves from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. Why? Strato has an answer. The answer to this is that the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea is lower. So it's this kind of arrangement. And the assumption is that liquids, a deceptively attractive assumption, the deceptively attractive assumptions which some Greeks espoused was that in this kind of situation, liquids will slowly flow in this direction. They will move down. Is this not natural? So this is the assumption, and here is an assumption where the stability of liquid depends, among other things, upon the precise level of the liquid, which can be understood and most naturally is understood in terms of the precise level of the centers of weight of the liquid. But Archimedes simply ignores these questions. Liquids do not possess, for him, centers of the weight. It doesn't exist as an object for him. Correct, but he avoids this and in this way makes liquids completely distinct from solids. And now let's look at the correlate question, a conceivable unified physics in which everything is liquid-like, where you worry about questions of pressure downwards. So a solid in liquid balances the balance of a solid in a liquid. Does it really remember how it works in Archimedes? In Archimedes, the stability of a solid in a liquid is completely independent of the liquid. It's a property that can be judged simply by the positions of the centers of the weight inside the solid itself. We abstract away the liquid, although this is the medium which gives rise to the very question of stability. Imagine that we're thinking about it differently. For instance, look at this vessel in the ocean and imagine that it is tilted. That's the key question. Is it going to right itself? for Archimedes, this is purely a question about the center of gravity here and the center of gravity there. However, there is a completely valid question. Here we're bringing in a consideration which is valid, having to do with the fact that being tilted, the vessel will press down the liquid unequally. The liquid itself would be affected. So there are ways in which the solid and the liquid interact, in which you should, in principle, bring to bear the question of the pressure applied downwards on the surfaces of the liquid downwards. Archimedes ignored this. In this case, once again, it's justified as a form of obstruction. You ally the problem that complicates a mathematical question and makes it more difficult to solve, but he makes this decision to ally this, and the result is that he never looks at liquid-type questions when he looks at solids, at solid-type questions when he looks at liquids. He simply uses a different kind of physics. He uses a different set of rules for how physical objects behave when he talks about the different kinds of matter. So, the main thing really is that Archimedes makes a decision to have a bifurcated universe, that this bifurcation is determined by the center of the weight. There are those things that need the center of the weight, there are those things that don't. Those that need the center of the weight need nothing else, they need only the center of the weight. This is the way in which the treatise works, and perhaps most fundamentally, this is the thing which never gets mentioned. Everything I said so far is simply really an exegesis on the single word physis that occurs in the first hypothesis. Archimedes never discusses the fact that he's got a bifurcated universe. You have to work it out for yourself. It is as if this is not explicitly a problem. So I'm not at all an expert on early modern science. Many of you have read more on this than I did, but here are observations coming from an ancient, the perspective of ancient science. If you're looking at what happens in early modern science, very often what you see is a desire to explain the totality of physics. All natural motion of translation is the result of proper heaviness. This is Galileo de Motu, his first try in physics, where what he did was to try to generalize Archimedes' floating bodies as a theory of the motion of bodies in general. So he tries to generalize it to all bodies. That's the main goal for him. So this is anti-Aristotelian, obviously. So he's rejecting the Aristotelian rule, where the bifurcation is very, very minimal. It's simply a bifurcation of signs. Some go up, some go down, but there's a single rule that holds for everything. But it's not merely anti-Aristotelian, it's also non-Archimedean. Galileo does something that simply did not seem to interest Archimedes in the same way. And in general, one major thing that happens in the open universe of early modern science is that everything gets compressed in terms of its ontology. So there's no ether. The stars are not ether, they're matter, the same matter as we have in the sublunar realm. And down here, once again, atomism basically tends in the direction of making everything composed of atomistic solids. In a way, you can say that that's the direction. The direction, in a way, is to tend to make everything Earth-like. In Archimedes, you don't have everything Earth-like. You've got the Earth-like things, and you've got the water-like things, and they are completely distinct. If you want to do a unification of them, I'm not the one to provide this, says Archimedes. The world is not unified. He's not interested in this kind of unification. I would say maybe because he's not really interested ultimately in the same kind of question that Galileo was interested in, what is the universe made of? This is what I would suggest here. But let's move forward. Let's move forward. So here is something where I'm somewhat less speculative, because I'm close to the text, Now I'm not going to talk about interpretation. It's not an exegesis of a single word, but here is a subtle point. So what I would try to argue is that the very nature of the motion that's being discussed, the very nature of the argument that's being proposed, is an argument that's very deeply conceived within mathematical terms, within the tools that we're used to in pure geometry. So here is how we're going there. So I go back to the same diagram. This is the diagram where this is set out. We're looking at the palimpsest, and we're looking at the first argument concerning the stability of the solid in liquid. The key question that we're trying to understand. What happens to a solid in liquid? Well, here's what we're looking at. We're looking at a segment of a sphere. That's the first object that's discussed because it's relatively simple. We're looking at a segment of a sphere immersed in the liquid. It's lighter than the liquid, so only parts of it are immersed in the liquid. This is a kind of vessel, if you will, and we don't care about scale, so it's very big relative to the Earth. That's the segment of a sphere, which is taken to be greater than a hemisphere. That's the center of the sphere, that's kappa. So once again, that's a segment of a sphere. That's the Earth, which is all made of liquid for the sake of this exercise. That's the center of the sphere, and that's the center of the Earth. And that's useful. Here is a diagram that we pick up in the palimpsest. We didn't have it. We wouldn't have it before the palimpsest. And this is the one criticism I have to the great genius author who produced the text of Archimedes that we now use, Johann Ludwig Heiberg. The one criticism I have for him is that he did not bother to report the contents of the diagrams in the manuscripts he was looking at. So here is our manuscript, here is the diagram, and here is this funny observation. The center of the Earth is extremely eccentric. So why is that? Why is the center of the Earth eccentric in this particular diagram? Well, I want to bring a number of comparisons, once again emphasizing diagrams that are based on manuscript authority, which I think goes back into ancient practice. So here is the diagram for Euclid's Elements, Book 3, Proposition 13. A circle does not touch another at two points. And here is the diagram. Here is the circle touching externally another circle. And I want to be clear about this. Probably in the text that you've read of Euclid, you've seen what almost always happens in modern diagrams, namely this impossible circle was represented as a kind of a punctured tire, almost a circle, as convincing a circle as you can make it, given the constraints of this proposition. Not so in the original manuscript evidence for Euclid, which is very, very consistent about this. The pseudo-circle is very clearly not a circle. It is instead a loon-shaped thing, which is obviously the most non-circle thing you can have. And here is another example, spiral line 13. This is now from Archimedes. The argument is that it's very similar in character. A tangent does not touch a spiral at two points. How do you do this? You draw a line and assume that it is a tangent at two points. How does Archimedes draw the diagram for this? Here is a line. Okay, this is a straight line. I want to emphasize this. This broken thing, it's a single line. It's not two lines, it's a single line. And once again, modern diagrams make it a line that pretty much does touch the spiral at two points, a bit defeating the purpose. In Archimedes, it's very clear, no, in order to have such a line, you have to have something really absurd. Now, both those propositions, 313 and spiral lines 13, and this now can be generalized to the whole category, these are proofs by contradiction. These are proofs where you assume something that cannot happen. And the rule is that we moderns very often have feel a certain need to make the proofs look as reasonable as possible. Give the contradiction, the absurdity, the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it's true. Let's try it. in the diagrams that we see in antiquity, there isn't a similar fate in the diagram anyway. The diagram is not taken to represent the reality. And so you play with it. You let the diagram show the absurdity. You let the diagram display the impossibility, its own impossibility. The proof shows that the circle cannot be drawn, and the diagram once again emphasizes that the circle cannot be drawn. So that's what we see. That's the practice. And now this makes sense, because now we can note that there is, in fact, one verbal hint in the proof that suggests once again that it is conceived as a proof by contradiction. So here is the proof for 1.8. Let me give a quick run through this. Lambda, as I mentioned, is the center of the Earth. Kappa is the center of the sphere. And obviously the part that's shared, the part that's immersed in the liquid, is a kind of a lens-shaped thing. And I think it will be evident. Archimedes never proves those things. He lets the readers figure those things for themselves. It will be evident that the center of the weight of this lens will be on its axis, which is the line joining the two centers of the sphere. This can be proved. It's not immediately clear, but it can be proved. So the center of the weight of this lens thing is going to be on this line. It's going to be rho then. Rho is the center of weight of the part immersed in the liquid. The hemisphere as a whole, well, the center of weight of the sphere clearly is kappa, its very center. We remove the entire top thing, so the center of the weight of the remainder must go down in this direction, and so it will go down along this axis, let's say to the point xi. So here is the point xi, here is the point rho. Rho is the center of weight of the part that's immersed. So the center of weight of the remainder is going to be, by planes in equilibrium, is going to be along the continuation of rho c somewhere on that direction, so it's going to be on sigma. So this is how we find the relative topological positions of rho, xi, and sigma, in particular rho being on one side of the axis, sigma being on the other side of the axis. All of this Archimedes does not clarify. All of this you need to make for yourself. But this is how the argument works. So at the beginning we say, what are we even trying to prove? We're trying to prove that a segment of a sphere will come to a stand upright. Try to tilt it, and it will right itself, as long as the base remains completely outside the liquid. Okay, the figure comes to a stand upright in such a way so that the axis of the segment is along a perpendicular. In this context, understood to mean going all the way down to the center of the earth. Proof. What is the proof? Let the figure, if possible, a dunaton, be inclined. That's the verbal hint. The verbal hint, together with the grammatic hint, makes it very clear. We're inside a proof by contradiction. Assume it is inclined. Assume it does not stand upright. Though there is something strange going on. Because it's not impossible. You're with me? It's not impossible. You can tilt it. You can actually tilt it. But it says, a dunaton, let it be inclined. Okay. So we're going through the argument, we're finding rho, we're finding xi, we're finding sigma. Since the weight, so what happens here? Remember the rules that we have. Sigma, the weight of the figure which is outside the liquid is carried downwards along the line lambda sigma towards the center of the earth, center of the weight, moving towards the center of the earth. Here is the line of motion. Okay. The weight in the liquid is carried upwards along the line rho kappa. They don't cancel each other out. They don't line a single line. It is clear, therefore, that the figure shall not rest, but its parts at epsilon, those parts, will be carried downwards, like this. It's going to tilt. It's going to tilt like this. Those at eta, upwards, and will always be carried in the same direction, until theta comes to be along a perpendicular. What went on with the proof by contradiction? Where is the proof of by contradiction? Well, it's right there. What's the argument? The argument is Let's assume the segment is stable at a position non-x, at a position not perpendicular. We obtain instability, so it is not stable at a position non-x, hence it will reach stability at position x. Now, position x is stable, transparently. You can prove this. Archimedes is right. You can actually prove this. What he ignores, simply elides once again as a question, is the question of the need to specify a physical path from instability to stability. In fact, it is impossible to tell at all. We know that it will go in a certain direction, but we don't know where it will get to in the next moment, so to speak. We cannot tell what is the motion of the segment. We cannot calculate an actual motion to the segment, and we can't tell that it will come to a rest. It's completely possible, based on the argument that Archimedes developed, that the motion will be asymptotic, so that starting from a condition of instability, you will never reach stability. There isn't a proof that the path has to be completed. This has not been proved by Archimedes at all, because he cannot even generate a path. There is no meaningful answer to the question, what happens? What's the route that the segment follows? Because there isn't a physical transition at all. The transition is from non-stable to stable. It's a transition that happens for Archimedes, not in a physical space, but in a logical space. It's not just that the objects are abstractly represented by lines and circle. It's also that the objects are transported from a place where you need to move from one point to another to a place where you can transition automatically from one point to another through logic alone. Through the impossibility of one point, you get to its opposition. From the instability of the unstable, you get to the stability of the stable. This is the way the argument, I think, is meant to be convincing. This is what makes it compelling for Archimedes. So, I'm suggesting that at this moment, there is an extension, once again, not just of mathematical idealization, there's an implicit extension from logical states to physical states. You think of physical states as operating under the same kind of logic that governs the transition between logical states. That's an argument that I would like to suggest. Once again, it's subtle, but it has certainly, I think I can prove that the argument is understood to be based on a proof by contradiction, which is something for which the diagram is crucial. And if so, we need somehow to account for the fact that at its surface, there's no contradiction. What does the contradiction do? It supplies the logical mechanism which allows Archimedes to skip the need to specify a physical path. Now, I'm looking at this more widely. Now I'm looking more widely at what happens in floating bodies. You know very well, of course, the law of buoyancy and the sphericity of the Earth. I just discussed the stability of the segments of the sphere. All of this taken together is book one, which is about a quarter. Three quarters, and by far the much harder three quarters, are book two. And book two are all in dialogue with the theory of conics. So above all, what happens here is a study on the conditions of stability, not of a segment of a sphere, but of a paraboloid of revolution. What happens when you take a parabolic segment and rotate it around its axis? This kind of object, which is like a segment of a sphere, but much more difficult, what are the conditions of stability for this object? Everything else in this treatise is introduction to this incredibly sophisticated and difficult mathematical problem. So a bird's eye view, what we're doing is an exhaustive survey of all the possible configurations, ending up in a paradoxical result that, among other things, defeats itself. You get to a configuration that cannot be solved. The classification, the taxonomy, is based on two dimensions. we can see this here. There are two quick questions. How heavy the solid is and how elongated it is. A parabolic segment, all parabolas are similar, but parabolic segments can differ from each other according to how far they are from the vertex of the parabola when they're cutting it. They can be very close to the vertex of the parabola, in which case we've got a very shallow bowl-shaped thing, or they can be very elongated, in which case we've got a more bullet-shaped thing. So these are the possibilities we have in terms of length. There are also there's also a range of possibilities concerning the weight. Obviously, if it's way heavier than the liquid, it's going to sink to the bottom of the liquid. However, if it's lighter than the liquid, it can be very light, in which case practically all of the solid is outside of the liquid, or they can be almost as heavy as the liquid, in which case they'll be very deeply immersed inside the liquid, almost all of them immersed inside the liquid. So we've got these two parameters. What's the shape of the parabolic segment? And what's the shape of the part of the parabolic segment? How much of the parabolic segment is inside the liquid? So we're looking at all those combinations. And what we find is that if it's fairly short, so those balls, they behave a bit like segments of a sphere. That's not surprising. They stay stable. Also, if it's very heavy, so that most of it is inside the liquid, it will stay stable rather like a sphere. There are interesting things happening when it is rather light, so quite a bit of it gets out of the liquid, and rather long. In those cases, it does reach stability, but the stability, interestingly, is reached when the segment is tilted to some extent, and we can measure the precise angle in which it will be tilted. And interestingly, you can take very long parabolic segment, a parabolic segment that really looks like an elongated bullet, and you immerse it, think of it in varying weights. So you can make it very heavy, and then it will be completely stable upright, or you can make it a bit heavier, and it will gradually tilt to the side, and then, quite naturally, we're not surprised, as more of it gets outside of the liquid, then it ultimately reaches the point that it is completely immersed, half immersed, sunk in the liquid. But then surprisingly, as it gets even lighter and even less of it is in the liquid, it begins to right itself. And once again, it reaches stability in a tilted position. That's the paradox. That's a paradoxical result which is very, very counterintuitive. And this is what Archimedes, in fact, chooses to finish the treatise upon. He finishes the treatise, he goes through those. The last proposition is very, very complicated, going through all those six combinations. Each of them involves a terrifically complicated argument in conic sections involving all kinds of auxiliary diagrams. But at the end, you get to this case, then this case, then this case, then this case, skipping the bad case, and then getting to the bad case and ending on the paradox. Ending on the moment of paradox, which is also a moment of defeat, because at this point, where even the base is immersed in the liquid, it's not just that now it's bad news for you if you happen to travel this and this is your boat. It's also bad news because it means that now we've reached a position where we can no longer find the center of gravity. Everything works through the fact that if we have an object, a segment of a parabolic segment immersed in a liquid, and we have parts of it immersed in the liquid but not the base, what we've got once again is a segment of a parabola. So we've got a parabolic segment within a parabolic segment, and we compare the two. At this point, we've lost it. At this point, we no longer have an object that we can actually compare. At this moment, we can no longer compare where the objects are. And at this point, the diagram collapses, the mathematics collapses. So I gave you a hint. It's just a hint. And it wouldn't be much better if you read the text. The text is impossible. But a hint of how deeply embedded all of this is within the complications of conic sections. In fact, I think there might be something Apollonian. So this is an outrageous suggestion. Now I'm really out on a limb. I think I'm right, but I'm out on a limb. So I have to admit this. And it's an outrageous treatise. It's meant to be hard. It's meant to be self-defeating. I think it might hide this as well. There is this phrase in this treatise. Esto toma apol orthogonio con utoma. Of course, it's in Doric. Let there be the section of Paul, a section of a right-angled cone. Now, this stands out. So the plane section of the paraboloid of revolution, the thing we're studying, the key thing that we're studying here is a parabola, and this parabola is always introduced, no matter where it is within the relevant proposition, always introduces alpha pi omicron lambda, which is very marked in the practice of Greek mathematics, where typically we just reshuffle the deck of cards and reassign alpha, beta, gamma again and again each proposition. Indeed, specifically, parabolas tend to be three letters, not four. So this is really redundant, and clearly there is a meaning here. Clearly there is a meaningful pun. Of this I have no doubt. Where I go out on a limb is in the following suggestion. So you remember this. You know perhaps that conic sections used to be called section of a right-angled cone, this is the parabola, section of the obtuse-angled cone, that's the hyperbola, section of the acute-angled cone, that's the ellipse, and this Apollonius who renamed them, right? So bear in mind what Archimedes says again and again and again and again, 50 times in this treatise, the one repetitive phrase in this treatise. It is, let there be the section apol, a section of a right-angled cone. So it's interesting, right? It does make you think. And I think you could maybe one... Apol doesn't mean anything. The only thing that Apol could refer to is some kind of Apollo-based name. It could... Maybe he had a son called Apollonius Apollodorus. Maybe he visited the city of Apollonia and he wanted to dedicate the treatise to the memory of this place. I think there's something going on. No, seriously, I mean, there are all those options. You can't rule them out. I think it's possible that he's thinking about Apollonius. And I think in general it's possible. So for other reasons, this is controversial, but I think this has now been settled. Apollonius was indeed Archimedes' younger peer. And what goes on here? We've got this amazing tour de force of conic sections. So with or without the Apollo, I think this is what he's doing. It has this competitive display. Here is what you can do with conic sections. That's what he says. That's what he does. That's what he achieves here. Perhaps directly in competition with Apollonius. Also, you think you're doing something significant, changing the names of the conic. Here is what you can do with conic sections. I think that's what he's doing, possibly. I don't know. Now, so finally, a brief point about the response to Archimedes, because an important way of understanding all of this would be if we had some kind of sense of who read him and how he was read. This is the question now. So I actually think I have someone who read him. I think we see someone who read the Archimedes, but I'll need to explain quickly the underlying thought of Floating Bodies book two. So the beauty of it is the following. Here is the main segment, the entire segment, and here is the part that's immersed in the liquid, okay? And both of them are parabolic segments. And more than this, this is the beauty of parabolas. A diameter gives rise to diameters, gives rise to diameters. So here is the main diameter, and here is the secondary diameter of the smaller subsegment. And Archimedes has a proof that the center of the weight of a paraboloid of revolution is along the axis, along the diameter of the parabola that draws the paraboloid of revolution, along the diameter at two-thirds the way. So take those two-thirds, take the point theta and the point, is this what I, no, I defined here, the point theta and the point mu. Those will be the two centers of the weight, the center of the weight of the entire segment, the center of the weight of the part immersed in the liquid. Notice that now we moved to a flat Earth. Archimedes never told us this, but in fact, as he moves from the first part of the treatise to the second part of the treatise, from the study of the stability of spheres to the study of stability of paraboloids of revolutions, he moved all of a sudden from a spherical Earth to a flat Earth. This is necessary because otherwise we wouldn't be able to find the center of the weight. So this is why he plays this game around you. Okay, so we've got these two centers of the weight, and obviously, once again, the center of the weight of the part that's outside the liquid is going to be along the continuation of mid zeta. So now we know what interests us. This part outside will go from phi downwards. This part inside will go from mi upwards. So we need to know whether mi and phi are on the same side of, are on a single line or on the two sides of a single line. For this, it helps to follow the following observation. Here we've got the point of the vertex of the smaller subsegment. And from this vertex, we draw a perpendicular here. We draw the ordinate to the point iota. We also draw the perpendicular to this tangent from tau on to omega. And iota omega, then, is the section of the diameter, the section of this line, that's contained between the ordinate and the normal. This segment of the diameter is measurable. It is, in fact, a fixed line that's always equal to the half parameter. And this tells us why it's so important to look at the length of the segment that we're looking at. It's basically all based on this observation. Everything follows from this. The conic section theory remains brutal in its detailed applications, but that's the thought. That's the thought that we're always applying. The fact that we've got a fixed thing to measure here, and we're trying to measure where the point zeta would be relative to the point tau. That's the key question. So now I want us to look quickly at Dauclis on burning mirrors. Dauclis on burning mirrors is a treatise that survives only in Arabic, and we generally speaking assume that it was written at about the time of Apollonius, at about the time of this great generation of many mathematicians responding to the Archimedean challenge. I think Dauclis was specifically responding to Archimedes here. Here is the key idea. This is Dauclis on burning mirrors. So how does burning mirrors work? In burning mirrors, you assume that you've got the surface of a paraboloid of revolution, and you're looking at a section of it, just a parabola. Here is a parabola, and here's the axis and diameter of this parabola, and here we're taking an arbitrary line parallel. The rays of the sun are assumed to all be dropped on this parabola at a perpendicular, all of them parallel to this axis. This is the direction of the sun. And the sun is sufficiently distant away that all its rays are considered to be parallel to each other. Okay, so this line is parallel to this line, and it is somehow meant to represent a ray of the sun. And now we're doing the following. So it's a bit of a complicated construction, but we're taking this half parameter, which is HB, and then we apply it here as BE, and we bisect it at D. It's a long argument now based on properties of right-angle triangles and relationship between angles, but we can actually prove based on this that once we found the point D like this, we can actually ascertain that theta D will be equal to D zeta, will be equal to D alpha at the top. These lines are equal to each other. The angles here are therefore equal to each other. We've got the equality of these angles, but we also have the equality of, so this angle, PQ, is equal to this angle over here, but this angle over here is also obviously equal to the angle T, because there are parallel lines. So now we know that the angle here, T, is equal to the angle PQ here, and that's how rays are reflected from a mirror along an equal angle. So we know that whichever parallel line, the point D is independent of the choice of this line. The point D is determined purely by the property of the half parameter and what it cuts off from the diameter. between this right angle and between this right angle. It's exactly the same observation that we have here with GZ equals a half parameter. So no matter which line we take in parallel to S theta, because of the property of GZ, we actually know that the line falling on a point such as theta will always fall on the very same point D, which doubtless therefore interpret as saying, and therefore as a consequence, if we have these particular constructions, all the lines, all the rays of the sun will fall on the same point D, which means that at this point we can actually burn something through the use of a mirror, through the reflection of rays of light. And what's evident here, I think, if we're just rotating the diagrams, is that essentially we have the same diagram. We have the same diagram, and we have the same basic property as the key to the operation. Archimedes takes a property of the normal ordinate intersection with diameter, not in Apollonius conics, but pretty simple. He derives a conclusion which in itself is opaque and convoluted. No one would be interested in the relative position of two-thirds the diameter of the main segment, two-thirds of the parameter of the sub-segment, unless you provide it with a meaning. Doubtless takes the same result, gets a different conclusion, that once again a very opaque one. No one would be interested in the fact that lines would have a fixed angle with the parabola. It's not a very powerful result in and of itself, but he gets it a meaning. What do? You operationalize the geometry that you had. You get a geometrical result which is strong. It's strong as geometry, but it's not motivated enough as geometry. What does the physics do? The physical meaning forces you to look at this question. Now it's not just some kind of configuration. Now it's a configuration that needs to be studied. And through this, we get a meaning for this, what would have otherwise been an empty tour de force of conic sections. It's an important tour de force of conic sections, we now learn. It has a meaning. It can be operationalized. So what is the purpose of Archimedes' floating bodies? I gave you all sorts of hints suggesting what I think about this, and what I think about this is important because whether it's true or not, we're talking about the very beginnings of physics. This is how you study it, right? It's lab. The beginnings of mechanics. And I suggest that this is how it begins. It begins by the need to operationalize geometry. You start out from geometry and move towards physics, move towards mechanics, as a way of grounding your geometry, extending the field of the meaningfulness of your geometry. And that's why I'm saying Archimedes is not doing physics precisely. He's completely agnostic about the fact that he's bifurcating the universe. And I'm saying the very logic assumes not the motions of bodies, but the immediate transitions between logical states. Above all, this is a piece of conic sections, perhaps specifically in dialogue with a piece of pure geometry produced by Apollonius. And I suggest that maybe the very reception of the work can show that it was understood as pointing the way to how, in general, one can operationalize geometry. So thank you very much, and I look forward to continuing discussing this.